Here comes another exciting edition of the Mincing Rascals, so chock full of wisdom and humor this week, we now have a sponsor. I'm John Williams. Please share this pod with your friends. Imagine you're a campaign worker and we're your favorite candidate. Go door to door, or text your pals, or post us on Facebook. Today, it's How Safe Are We in Chicago? In stores, on trains, on the set of TV's Empire, pumping gas. We'll stitch those topics together. And Steve Bertrand's real anxious to talk about New Hampshire. How often does one get to say that? Plus, at the end, we take our usual visit to Trump land. And now, a word from our sponsor. This edition of the Mincing Rascals is sponsored by the Joint Relief Institute. So before we start mincing, let's talk about your wincing. Most Americans have knees, and over time, tissue deteriorates, much like your faith in government. It just goes away. The Joint Relief Institute puts a lubricant in there, your knees, not the government, to make them work pain-free. Although, if they did do that for Washington, I'd say lube the swamp. They put a lubricant into that exact spot where the tissue is missing or damaged, and by golly, things get going pain-free. Imagine if the Joint Relief Institute could put a pain relief substance all over our country, and suddenly America would go, oh, that feels better. Things would go smoother. Bills would get passed. Regardless of how you vote, you don't deserve knee pain. Actually, some people do, but this message isn't for them. Although there's an idea, a company that would deliver knee pain to people you don't like. Ha! This isn't that company, though. This one takes pain away. Call this number if you or someone you know has knees and they hurt. Ready? 708-888-0000. That's 708-888-0000, as in zero pain. Today is Thursday. It's February 13th, 2020. It's Valentine's Eve at 12:41 in the afternoon. This is John Williams. Welcome to another edition of the Mincing Rascals, the podcast we record at the studios of WGN Radio, downtown Chicago. Email the Rascals at johnwilliams@wgnradio.com.
I'm Steve Bertrand from the WGN Radio Newsroom.
I'm Justin Kaufman. I host evenings here at WGN Radio.
I'm Lisa Donovan with the Chicago Tribune. I write the Spin Politics newsletter out every afternoon.
I'm Eric. So I'm the lying dog face pony columnist from the Tribune.
Dang.
Oh, he goes Democrat.
No, I think you missed one word. Lying dog face pony.
Did I miss this?
So Rider? Lying dog face pony soldier.
Is pony soldier.
Joe Biden. Columnist instead of a soldier.
Oh.
I'm a soldier for the truth, however.
Oh, gosh, Lisa, I can't believe there's something I know about that you don't. This allow me to lord this over
Sorry.
You. So
once again, if I may, right before the podcast started, John outlined the local items we were going to go to before politics in Trump land. And Eric Zorn brings us right to national politics.
So anyway, Joe Biden was speaking to a group in New Hampshire, and one of the people was a young woman. She identified herself as a college student, and she asked him a question.
So you're arguably the candidate with the greatest advantage in this race. You've been the vice president. You weren't burdened down by the impeachment trials. So, in the participation. So how do you explain the performance in Iowa, and why should the voters believe that you can win the national election?
That's a good question. You ever been to a caucus? No, you haven't. You're a lying dog faced pony soldier. You said you were, but you're...
Who's Joe Biden?
He said it in a friendly way.
You're a lying dog faced pony soldier, which I don't think is a nice thing to say to anybody, particularly a young woman.
It comes out of some old cowboy movie, right?
Well,
it's not a theory, but we haven't been able to find it.
We want Joe to come out fighting. That's what people want to see.
Against young college women who ask an honest, good question?
I would have to say that. Do you think gender plays a role? I'm going to throw that back.
Really?
Oh,
he would not have said that to a young man.
Oh, no, he would have said it to a young man, but I think it looks worse because he said it to a young woman.
Yeah, yeah. Because he wanted to wrestle that guy in Iowa, didn't he?
He called him bald-faced liar or something. Yeah.
Wrestle.
You're selling access to the president just like he is. So
you're a damn liar, man. That's not true. And no one has ever said that. No one has heard that. And you want to check my shape on? Let's do push-ups together, man. Let's run.
I did that once. And I told this briefly, but the old timer Zorn will remember, maybe no one else. When Richard Elrod was running against Jim O'Grady for Cook County Sheriff, right? Elrod was the incumbent. And I was with O'Grady up on Halsted Street. And I said, well, you know what? They're saying is that you're doing this, and I was a young reporter, and I didn't know who the they were really. And O'Grady said, well, who's the they?
Yeah.
And I said, excuse me? He said, you said they're saying it. Who's the they? And I mean, there was a lesson I'll never forget.
What's the lesson? Does there have to be a they?
Well, it was a lazy question. I was, you know, saying, when Trump says, they all say.
Or millions of people say.
Right. There are, right. Sometimes there's not a they. It's just the feel or the mood.
Here,
of it.
I've had that happen. What you do is you go through your notes. You go, your mom.
It's around here.
Right, your
somewhere.
Mama says it.
Your mama.
We'll come back to the national scene in a minute, but let's do start in Chicago. The Sun-Times has endorsed Kim Fox for state's attorney. She botched the Jussie Smollett case, they say, but she's rightly fighting more serious crime, including not counting as a felony any theft below $1,000. Two things here, guys. If it's true that they're putting more resources into more serious crime, shouldn't that take precedent? That's reason to endorse her. And what do you think about not challenging so seriously crimes of $999?
I think that that's media fodder, the $999 and less, only because, yeah, it may be that the state's attorney is not going to necessarily throw the book at someone who stole a $400 jacket, but there's still a process. The police are going to arrest you. You're going to go to Cook County. You're going to be charged, all of that. So to say that, you know, that's out there and people, petty criminals know that, and that's why there's more brazen crime on Michigan Avenue is hogwash.
I was going to say, I don't think it's media fodder as much as it's anti-Kim Fox fodder.
Right.
You know, they bring it up all the time.
Oh,
right
I think it's media fodder. They're not the same?
But, well, I do think, though, there are people talking about this and not necessarily linking it to her, linking it to police. We had this conversation at Thanksgiving, a retired small business owner talking about other small business owners on the far north side neighborhood saying, two good-sized thefts, and I'm done.
Oh, right.
And so, and not necessarily linking it to
her. What does that mean? And I'm done. What do you say?
Well, I mean, if you have two people come in there and take, you know, a few thousand dollars worth of merchandise, and you're a small business, and you're not open, sort of, you know, like the 7-Eleven 24/7, it can knock you out, especially with rent prices going. Yeah, knock you out financially. Rent prices going up at some of these places. So I am hearing about it, and I'm not necessarily hearing about it tied, and not just at Thanksgiving dinner, not necessarily tied to her.
But again, it's not that they didn't make it a crime. It's making it a misdemeanor. They're not going to enforce it. And I think we did focus maybe. I kind of like that about Kim Fox in some ways. The other thing is your shop owner should take out insurance, really, because if he's being robbed, I would hope that would be insured.
Well, it's like anything else. You start claiming this on insurance, and that goes up and up.
Well,
and up.
I guess if it's a shoplifting, you're right. You have to prove it's
gone. So,
Kim Fox was elected 4 years ago on the premise and the basis she was going to lessen the jail population. That too many people, many brown and black young men were being arrested for anything under the sun.
And then sitting there for
months and months and months. So I get that concept. I think the issue right now is that there seems to be some that, and you saw this with the great piece the Tribune had today about bail reform and how Timothy Evans may be fudging the truth a little bit on who actually is committing crimes when they're let out on bond reform. Sorry, bail reform. But the point being to me is that I wonder if that's political collateral. Like, it's this idea that there are going to be criminals that if you don't put into county, you don't charge them and keep them in jail, they're going to come out again and they're going to do it again. And the question just becomes, is that enough to say that the whole process of what she's trying to do to reform the justice system in Chicago and Cook County needs to be thrown out? I don't know.
I'm not sure that that her challengers are saying needs to be thrown out. I think they feel. I mean, what I heard in our debate, Lisa was there for that too. That in front of the editorial board was that they felt that it had gone too far and they wanted to turn some of the knobs a little bit on that. As far as the crimes go, I have talked to the Illinois Retail Merchants Association, and they're very concerned about what they see as an uptick in shoplifting because they feel like they know that police don't respond, don't care anymore, and so on, and that there you have seen these groups of kids going into stores on Michigan Avenue and stealing stuff, and there doesn't seem to be the kind of fear that they used to have of being prosecuted.
No, that's what I'm saying. Kim Fox.
The police numbers back that up as well. That there is an uptick.
I understand, but the idea. I mean, we act as if, you know, all of Michigan Avenue wild in crimes happened when Kim Fox took over in 2016.
No.
We've been talking for 15, 20, 25, 30 years about kids going and messing with water tower or messing up and down Michigan Avenue.
I'm talking about neighborhood small businesses still feeling the heat of this. There is discussion. They feel the heat of this, and not just Michigan Avenue.
Well, that's not a Kim Fox issue. That's a Charlie Beck issue, right? I mean, that's
the
police issue, the current police superintendent.
And I got to say, I feel like Kim Fox has done a really good job in correcting some wrongful prosecutions. It was just, she just did like a fairly significant exoneration from the Watts cases, the brutal cop who had I think there were what, 12, a dozen of them or something like that?
It's hard
to argue against her policy changes. I mean, there's no argument against it. She is trying to, with some other elected leaders, trying to make sure that criminal justice is meted out in a way that is colorblind, that does not look at your socioeconomic level.
And that prioritizes worse crimes above lesser crimes that are more visible. But the way it plays out on my talk show, Justin, maybe yours too, is, oh my God, I can do a $900 crime and they don't care. No wonder the police don't want to get involved. Well, I mean, that's the narrative.
But that's when you've got to say they do care. It's just a different level crime.
I don't know.
They're arguing something that's not true. They're saying something on your show that's not true.
What are they saying that's not true?
They're saying that I can steal $900 worth of your stuff and I won't get prosecuted.
What do you think happens to somebody who steals $500 or $900 worth of stuff? I mean, really, how much time between them getting arrested and them being back on the street? I mean, aren't there worse consequences for somebody who's charged with a felony than with a misdemeanor?
Sure. Yes, there are.
I think they get some diversion and they get some supervision and diversionary programs. I think what most people want, and certainly what I would want, is I want a state's attorney who is smart on crime. I don't care about tough. I want them to have the policies in place that is going to make my person and my property as safe as can be in a free society.
That's a great distinction, Eric.
It's a bummer, too, because of this Jussie Smollett garbage that it has become the thing that everyone wants to talk about, or what they decide on what a state's attorney should be, and whether or not, if Jussie Smollett happens again, will we have the right state's attorney to make sure that Jussie Smollett gets charged? I feel like this is the right kind of conversation to have, and I haven't heard it. I haven't heard much about the state's attorney's race beyond the fact that Kim Fox loves celebrities.
But the Smollett thing is there, and we still don't know. We still don't know what happened there,
and we don't.
Something happened.
Well, and with this new case being charged, you're getting a whole nother round of sort of...
Which new case?
Six counts against this newly filed round of charges against Jussie Smollett, where you're feeling like it's a vote of no confidence in her leadership, at least.
Her campaign said it was joke, James Comey-like, it came out.
Boy, what a stupid thing for her to say.
That was
God.
She has shown the ability to make things this worse at every turn.
Communication.
I had my column this morning laid out what I think actually happened in this case, which is I don't think that... I know a lot of people have this big conspiracy theories, like she was trying to get in with the Obamas, or she was like some sort of celebrity sniffer or something like that. I think what happened here was that she saw this case and she thought that this would be a good example of how smart she is and how merciful and balanced she is. And she would like let this stupid little case go and just like forget about it. I got bigger things to worry about. She just, as I put in the column, she did not read the room. She didn't realize how raw this would make people. And so all the stuff about Tina Chen calling her and all the stuff like
that's the Obama term.
She's a former advisor to Michelle Obama.
Her former chief of staff. Mm-hmm. I don't think that played any role in her decision. I don't think she would have committed political suicide in order to get cozy with Michelle Obama.
Do you not buy the story? Do we just throw that out, that we don't buy the fact that she recused herself, that somebody else made the decision in her office?
Well, she didn't recuse herself,
right? Officially, she just said, "Oh, I'm taking myself out." She didn't go through the formal process.
Regardless of the formal process,
if she did, then the person who made that decision has yet to have that person step forward and explain his or her thinking. Yeah. The fact is that if she had just done, if she'd come out the week after that and said, "This is what I was trying to do. This is why I did this." And explained that and took the fall for it or whatever, but she has refused to explain herself all along, and it just and the story just keeps lingering there and hangs over every conversation I have about this race. And I understand everyone who's like Justin says, it's a stupid little case and nobody even got hurt.
I want to make something clear, though. I do think, and I've had listeners on my show have made me think of it differently. There's a lot that goes into faking a hate crime. And there's a reason that hate crimes are on the books, is to protect from bigotry, from assault based on race and your skin color, all that kind of stuff. And for this guy to use it in a way that I don't know if he knew he was or allegedly knew he, you know, all that kind of stuff, I can understand why people are bent out of shape about it.
Yeah.
And I get that. But I do agree that at the end of the day, the state's attorney has bigger fish to fry than a R&B star. I've heard your show. You called him a rapper. He doesn't rap.
Yeah. He's an R&B guy. I knew you were going to bust me on that. Thank you.
It was good. But I was like, this guy couldn't rap to save his life.
Lisa, what's the matter?
He's a smooth singer.
No, I just think that if anybody took a look at Dan Webb, the special prosecutor who was put in place to sort of examine both the Jussie Smollett, the allegations against him, and how the state's attorney's office handled it. If you look at that report that was released with the indictment this week, there is an incompetence that's defined in this report. It sort of revives this whole no confidence vote. He says in there that reasoning behind dismissing the charges last year he was indicted, Kim Fox, her office throws out the case essentially. It's like 3 weeks apart between his indictment and the case being thrown out. A, there's no evidence brought to bear that would show that there was a change. And two, they had made the argument, justified this, and said, well, we did this because we do this with a lot of cases. And
show
Webb
cases,
said,
right,
Webb said that there were no cases. And so it speaks to sort of some leadership issues.
I
still agree with her philosophy and what she has done, but it's still an issue. Yeah.
But what you're describing is mind-blowing. That's like federal prosecutors and introducing sentencing guidelines into a federal corruption case.
Here we go.
The next day saying, well, we didn't mean to do it. Right?
Well,
that's the Roger Stone case.
Can I circle back before we get to that?
Absolutely.
That complete flaming outrage. John, remind me, you did a click poll, a news click poll this week about this case, and you asked people, what was the exact question about, did Kim Fox do the right thing?
I think it was about the Sun Times editorial, and do you think they got it right? That is, in endorsing Kim Fox. And about 95% of the people that responded said no, they should not endorse Kim Fox, that they have no confidence in Kim Fox. They would not endorse their endorsement. 95% of the people that responded.
It's poorly timed, I thought. That came out on Monday, and then the new indictment comes out on Tuesday.
So what about that, Eric?
I've said all along that I thought Dan Webb should work fast on this because the primary is coming up, and it will be an outrage if he comes back and says Kim Fox did everything right, and it's after the primary and she lost.
So it will be an outrage if he
comes back after the primary and says she did everything wrong and she won. People have a right to know what he has found out about what happened in that office.
I think
Eric, the only person that's upset that this was put at 35 days is Kim Fox. There's nobody else. There's no op-eds and they're mad about it. He did a good job. He kept it in front.
But the point is the what we're curious about too isn't out yet, right? They're still looking at the way Kim Fox handled it.
Everybody's made up their mind about Jussie Smollett. He's really not the issue anymore. She's the issue.
Yeah.
And this report of Webb's skirts that. In fact, he says it comes to no conclusion.
But they're still looking at it, right? I mean,
they're still looking at it. Yes.
Lisa, you've covered, and I know this, but I don't understand what the 16 counts were the first time around and what the six are now. They seem similar, but was it the 10
disorderly
counts?
Conduct
but what
now.
My point is, was the 10 counts the part where the state's attorney looked at it and said, this is too many counts, let's throw it out? Why didn't he come back and just recharge 16 counts if it was so obvious that Kim Fox made a mistake?
He started from scratch. And so there's no way for us to know that because that is a secret process. Mm. So that right now, you won't have that explanation. We may learn that at the end of a jury trial or a plea, and he might be able to explain, or we might be able to sort of dig up the grand jury documents. But there's no way to know because it's such a secret process.
But one of those counts is essentially lying to police.
Yes.
But it still falls under the umbrella of disorderly conduct, which means for how many hundreds of thousands of dollars and for how many counts and for how much time, this is a disorderly conduct investigation that Chicago cannot pull itself out of. About the Sun-Times endorsement, can we trust her going forward?
I'm on the outside because I feel like with the minute that Jussie Smollett stuff started coming out, it seemed like it was much more of a Rahm Emanuel kind of thing. Like, this is perfect. People aren't going to pay attention to what I've done in the past. I'll just take the lead on Jussie Smollett. And Kim Fox threw it out, which I think was a normal thing to do, got caught up in politics. I think she's competent as a leader.
I don't think it was a normal thing to do. I really don't. I think it was an extraordinary thing to do. I think if she had just taken like a guilty plea and pay $10,000 in fine and do 2 days of community service or whatever the heck he did, You could say, well, you know, he got a guilty plea. But the fact that, I mean, she didn't even get a deal with them where he didn't go down to the courthouse
and claim his innocence.
They dismissed it. He forfeited his $10,000 bond. And then he went to one of her political backers, Reverend Jesse Jackson. He spent, what, 4 hours that day at Operation Push?
And they didn't know at the time, right?
And nobody knew it. This was all under, you
know. That was his community service.
Yeah, it was his community service. Mm. And so, you know. Yeah, I don't know what to think.
That summarizes it nicely.
I like her policy. I think I like the direction. But this is a screw up.
I mean, so when I say, do you trust her or do you have confidence in her ability to maybe be a more intelligent fighter of crime for Chicago? I think the crime lab backs up some of her initiatives.
Yes. I think it's a leadership issue.
I really want to know the whole story here.
Yeah, I do too.
Because
too.
It gives me a lot of qualms about her integrity, about her judgment. And that is central to the role of a prosecutor. And the prosecutor has to have the confidence of the public in those areas.
So, all right, we're moving on. So ready?
Yes. Moving on from this story,
HB 4571 was going to make it illegal to pump your own gas. What was most shocking to me about this story, here's the big thing I learned this week, is that for that to be House Bill 4571, 4,570 other bills had to be proposed by the Illinois House first.
I heard that.
Think about that.
I did not know that.
There was a state rep on which and he said, there have been 45,000.
On the Rules Committee, 4,500.
That have already been introduced this session.
This Mincing Rascals is reminding me how much I listen to John's show.
I know.
Because I heard that too, and I was like, oh, that's great. Just I know,
I'm nervous
amazing.
About you being in the
audience. I love it. No, it's a must listen to.
The lawmaker, Camille Lill, of Oak Park says that despite the language in the bill, she doesn't want to ban people from pumping gas. What she wants to do is make full service stations more available for safety and convenience. If that's so, then the one sentence proposal with her name on it should not have been, quote, no gas may be pumped at a gas station in this state unless it is pumped by a gas station attendant employed at the gas station.
She said, I think it was on WTTW, or maybe, I don't know which station, but she said it was a conversation starter.
Yeah, sure. Was
that all legislation?
She's a talk show host now.
No, I said thank you.
She says that
she's gunning for your job, Williams.
All legislation should be out there, and the person who proposes, the lawmaker who proposes this stuff, should be open to changes, and that. But it is confusing to me. She did say, it was never intended to bar people from pumping their own gas.
Understanding of this proposal as it now exists is that there are people who are disabled, who have difficulty pumping their own gas, and they have to hunt for service stations that have full service because most
and
stations
And I never
don't.
Thought about that, Eric.
I never did either. That's a very different question than the question of whether every station should always have somebody pumping all the gas. I don't know how I feel about mandating that level of let's call it disability access for gas stations, what that would add to the cost of gasoline, whether that's just something that we do the way we have curb cuts and other accommodations to people who
that's
can't.
That's an entirely different story, though.
Well, she should have said that.
I think if you're in the hunt for those stations, they are there. I have a mother-in-law who didn't get out for – she doesn't drive now, but she did not get out to pump her gas, and she always knew where – there was a place that they that there was that there
now here's my here's my question though is that on us as the media because it was the original stories that were done by mostly 10 o'clock news that night because I was on the air at that time and it wasn't really there was no deep dives from the Trib or the Sun Times
it was a one sentence bill
with a paragraph story but the headlines were will Illinois be a full service gas station and my point being
like
that once we started looking into her bill was that really the intention and the rest of our whole community just went crazy
again well, it was a, there was one sentence one
John
sentence.
Said it was just the one sentence how
and
are you
she,
supposed to
and
look
she went invisible
that?
She just She was not available after that. If she wanted to have a conversation about it, knowing she was going to throw this out there, she should have taken my call.
I love that she represents Oak Park, so she's like, I will give the exclusive to Channel 11.
Yeah. And she was at a town hall meeting at the library, because that's so very Oak Park of her.
Library, what a snob.
Who will understand me most? Channel 11 will understand me most.
Speaking of transportation, we can leave that. Steve's bored of it already, I know.
Well,
Steve only wants things on the podcast that are, you know, matter.
It's a good time. I have limited time.
Oh.
I like to talk about national politics.
Right.
And we're going to spend 15 minutes now about the L after midnight. Go ahead.
Imagine it's 10:30 after a DePaul game, and the Red Line stop is just a few blocks away from Wintrust Arena, near McCormick Place in the South Loop. What advice do you give your daughter, wife, self, husband, friends about taking a CTA train after 10 o'clock at night downtown Chicago?
People who live in Chicago are well aware that that is a different transit system at night.
Yeah.
And I think that this story is not new, meaning this, I know that there's an uptick, and I think that it's the brazen attitude of a 3 o'clock in the afternoon after Thanksgiving attack at the Lake Street L that gets everybody like, what? But anything that you see about these stories where you're like, at 2 a.m. someone was traveling, you're like, man, I've been on that train at 2 a.m. And Pete Zimmerman, who's my producer, he gets out of here. He takes the Red Line at 1 o'clock in the morning. He doesn't feel it's changed. I talked to him about it. He feels... like, you got to be aware. You just got to know how to ride the train.
How old is he?
He's probably in his 40s.
Tell him he looks in his 20s. But I mean, if you're a young man, if you're a 40-year-old male of some disposition, maybe it's easier for you to feel confident surviving that Red Line trip than for other people.
The man at Wake Night who used to produce me in the Business Lunch was mugged on the L.
Yeah,
and seriously.
Mid-20s.
To me, this is an unacceptable answer. Well, then you shouldn't ride it in certain areas at certain times of the day. Then why are you running the damn trains then? I'm having trouble, Justin, getting the top of the food chain over there to come on my show. But it's like they said, no, you should feel confident riding the train, and if there's a problem, you hit the red button.
But no, is it the red button? I thought it was the blue button. Usually it's too late by then.
Well, that's, you know, it. That's after something's happened.
And also, there is that waiting window period where there was a guy screaming. He obviously had some very clear mental health problems, but saying he was going to kill everybody on the train. But he was by the button. And so it was sort of like, I have a feeling he's not going to do anything, but do I press the button? And then they come on and go, what do you need? And you're going to say, well, there's a man here who's screaming. Right. Hold on a second. Give it a second. He'll do it again.
You say nothing. Their protocol is to assume that something is happening that you can't speak now. Right. I don't know if that's any consolation to anybody. I'm not sure what the response times
John,
are.
I just wonder, because you have to route this story back. And we've all covered Chicago long enough to remember that it was during Daley, maybe when Frank Cruzzi was in as a CTA chair, that they made a choice to get rid of people on that train. Mm-hmm. They made the choice. It was cheaper. Police, they laid off. They said, no more CTA police. They went to the guy who now is like, Clybourne. They went to the automated everything, and there were no more threat of people walking through the trains that worked for the CTA to maybe scare people from saying, I'm going to kill everybody.
You're right. And even right before that, they had decided, well, we're not going to put them on the trains. We'll put them in cars, which makes no sense whatsoever.
So now I think there is a problem.
The squad cars would follow the CTA.
That's all after the fact. What do you think?
Well, no, they cut the labor force dramatically by not having any conductors. There's the motor person. Is that what the person who drives the train? Person. That's the only employee on the train. On most platforms that I'm on these days, they've gotten rid of the dogs. They've gotten rid of the guards on the platforms.
You're right.
So there isn't. Sometimes you see Chicago police down on the platforms.
So hearing Brian on your show talking about, well, we have a deal with the police. I'm like, and the conversation we had about shoplifting, where the police have other things to deal with, and maybe investigating if. It's the same thing. The police, you can't put the police everywhere, and you can't get them to necessarily care about prevention.
Whose job is it?
It's the CTA's job. They just unfunded it 20 years ago.
Well, there is an issue, though. I like Pete. I know Pete, so I'm not ripping him, but I ride that same train line, and I have seen a difference.
In
what's going on.
It's worse.
And I feel like it's an issue with, you know, we won't go the long road here. I'll try not to, but like there are fewer places for poor people to live, homeless people to set up, you know, to shelters. And so what you're seeing are more people on that line. So that's one thing. I said and then you're also seeing sort of the opioid epidemic unfold on there. I saw all of it one night. I had to work late, was coming home. And no, I wasn't. I had to go back and get my car, and I was coming back downtown. So I'm on the Red Line, and these two guys run in at North and Clybourne, and they have a duffel bag, and they are running into one of those little compartment areas. And I look back, and they're firing up. They get spoon heat and whatever, and then they're shooting
on the train
while I'm on it. And do I say something? Because I'm like, look at these guys. Look what they're wearing. They can't get out. They couldn't bail out of jail. They're not hurting me, but they're hurting themselves. And also, what the hell happened here? How is it that people are able to openly shoot up in a CTA train car at 11:30 at night on a Friday?
Question was, do you feel comfortable riding the train at that hour?
And I didn't. After that, it scared me.
You know, yeah. I actually do, but I'm a large person, a large male. I would not. My daughter goes to IIT, and I am nervous anytime she has to take the green line back down there or the red line, anytime other than rush hour.
I understand if you're running the CTA and you want to keep fares down and do it efficiently, mm-hmm. why you get rid of the motorman. Those, you know, the guy who mm-hmm. rolled down the window yep. and said, Fullerton, not Fullerton. You know, he wasn't needed anymore. Now, if his secondary job, if he happened to be eyes on the train, then
watch who's coming out. Watch those two guys coming out at North and Clyburn.
Well, then you hire people, security, right. to be on
those
trains.
I'd like to see a calculation,
that,
Steve,
you know?
How much it would cost. What it would have raised fares if we had a live person 24/7 on at least every platform, if not strolling up and down every train.
My point is, I'm not saying that you shouldn't have that. I think that's probably a good idea. I'm saying that it wasn't the role of the conductors in every other car to do that. So instead of paying them for what are obsolete jobs, pay security guards or pay monitors or something.
But there used to be at least one or two people on the train that would be the person you see walking back and forth that wasn't the conductor, right.
yeah.
not necessarily just the
unfairs.
And I do think that once you start sort of seeing this stuff sort of shaved down, like, okay, you can shoot up on the train, you can do this on the train, you can do that, people feel sort of like, I don't care if those cameras are there. Give me your wallet. Give me your phone. I think it's a different ballgame.
I do, too. And I feel like a fool. Because I was the guy deciding whether or not to get on the red line after the DePaul game. Mm-hmm. And I thought, what kind of a dope am I? It's right there. I'm Mr. Public Transportation yeah. now, so get on the damn train. And I did, and it went fine. But I thought, if something bad happens here, and at that stop, bad stuff does happen, I know my wife or a friend would have said to me, well, what the hell are you getting on the train for at that hour, at that location?
It's not just that hour, though. This is the thing that I think people are missing as mm-hmm. well. I just dropped my wife off to go out to O'Hare for something on the Blue Line at 6 in the morning, 6:30 to, you know, right, I think it was rush hour. Wouldn't have thought about safety at all. She gets on there. She says, nobody else is on the car except for two guys sleeping. One of them shirtless. He gets up. He's got something to say to her and another older woman that are there. And there is no other human being around. The train is gone. And this is 6:30 in the morning on a weekday. This, you know, and that's the point. I think if you ask just riders on the bus routes or riders on the train routes and rush hour, there is still a level of chaos. And I'm saying chaos like the big C, you know, like the Joker. I'm saying like chaos, a little C, where there's just no. It feels to me that the CTA is unguarded.
Yeah,
it's the streets. If you want to go on it, it's the streets.
We're going to go now to the national political scene before Steve Bertrand leaves the room.
I've got about 3 minutes, so
just have at it, Steve.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I thought we would start actually with Iowa and New Hampshire.
Really?
And the Democrats. What was the big takeaway from what happened in New Hampshire?
I think the big takeaway was that Michael Bloomberg is going to be the presidential nominee for the Democratic Party.
Really?
Yeah. I mean,
why do you say that?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I love Joe Biden, but Joe Biden just got. He called it a gut punch, I think.
Your headline isn't Amy had a nice showing?
My headline is Amy had a great showing. What's interesting was that the debate mattered. You know, she told that great story about FDR.
There's an old story of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And when he died, his body was put on a train and went up across America. And there was a guy standing by those tracks along with so many Americans. And he had his hat on his chest and he was sobbing. And a reporter said, sir, did you know the president? And the guy says, no, I didn't know the president, but he knew me. He knew me. And I will tell you this, there is a complete lack of empathy in this guy in the White House right now. And I will bring that to you. If you have trouble stretching your paycheck to pay for that rent, I know you.
Yeah.
I think is a great story.
She repeated that line.
So I thought she had a great debate. I think Buttigieg might have beaten Bernie Sanders had she not had that great debate. I'm still not convinced. I would love to see him win the nomination, but I just don't know if the country, and I know Rush Limbaugh got in trouble for saying it in a less articulate manner, but I just think there's a part of the country that's not ready to vote for a gay man. I have a gay daughter. That concerns me.
Yeah, but that will rally.
To me, that
rallies a Democratic base. If you get people like Rush Limbaugh or the president, who will probably step in it soon with a tweet, talking about that issue. Is a country ready to see two men kiss on a debate stage? You will get a rally. And the community,
which side will the rally be on?
Well, but think, the gay community is
absolutely. If you're going to lose the black vote, think of the other forces you could marshal, particularly if Trump decided to pick that fight.
I don't think he would. I think he'd be smart enough to stop. Well, you know, but my point being that I wonder, that's the one area where you're looking for that galvanizing moment. You're looking for that, Democrats are looking for that Obama moment where everyone kind of comes together behind one candidate. And you're playing with fire if you're Rush Limbaugh and company, and you're starting to get into the word that this person could not be, because of their lifestyle, they can't be president.
Well, at the end of last week, they said, who's going to win, and who could best beat Trump? And I said, Elizabeth Warren. And she'll be watching on Super Tuesday like the rest of us. So I was wrong there.
Well, I just, the thing about Buttigieg is that I feel like it is his youth that is going to get in the way. It's odd to me, however, that a lot of the progressives are branding him as such a moderate. Most of his policy proposals, compared to Obama's, for instance, he is more progressive, more liberal than Obama. It just happens to be that the entire window for the Democratic Party has moved to the left.
That's it, but he's less progressive than Warren or Sanders.
I don't really understand, going back to the basics, I don't really understand why we're saying here, oh, everything's changed after Iowa and New Hampshire, when everybody said Biden was going to do lousy, that he needed to go to South Carolina, just move on to that point, and that would be the true test.
Bloomberg didn't do anything in
right.
those
states. Nobody was saying that he was going to do well at all, but now we're saying the smartest people in the room are saying, well, no, you know, now he did lousy, so he's
so what's
basically
your point?
Out of it.
That
I don't
he's
understand.
Still in it? Well, he's still
I don't know. How do we know?
I think he did a lot less well than we thought he was going to do.
Okay.
I
mean, he was fifth place.
He was single digits for a former sitting vice president under a very popular president.
Right.
And then you look at the South Carolina poll, where was it Bloomberg who had a big jump in African-American mm-hmm. support that coincided with Biden's drop? I mean, I do think he's in big trouble.
Does Bloomberg run at risk of losing that support after this week? It's been a terrible week of unearthed audio.
Well, it'll probably be more stuff
looking back. I mean, if I were an African American voter,
explain that a little
bit. Stop and frisk, and he had said some things at an Aspen? I forgot where it was, but people are unearthing audio from him talking about he had said, well, there's a reason why crime comes from one area, and we know it. It's between 15 and 25-year-old black men.
Take the description, Xerox it, and pass it out to all the cops. They are male minorities, 15 to 25.
And so we're putting all our cops in one area. And then stop and frisk, which he accepted or widely used, was obviously the black community is not a fan of that, which is essentially letting police officers jump out of cars, throw kids against the wall and say, you know, I better not see you here again.
Throw them against the wall and frisk them.
Now he says, no, I made a mistake.
I now see that we could and should have acted sooner and acted faster to cut the stops. I wish we had. I'm sorry that we didn't.
I inherited it from Giuliani.
Right, but the problem is going to be that when you have him on tape, I mean, when you have the president of the United States being able to tweet, you're a racist.
I wrestle with my own characterization of a billionaire buying the election, because he certainly is buying the time, the ad space to do it. But it's not like he's Tom Steyer. You know, he's got government experience. He's got a story of leadership. He's genuinely capable, right. I think, and able to be president. So when it's characterized as he's quote unquote buying the election, I think that's selling it short. I think he's getting a story.
Well, he is buying the election.
Well, he's getting a story out of Governor Rauner and Governor Pritzker have bought their elections.
This is
right?
So maybe that doesn't make you a bad potential executive, but. Did you see how much money he has spent? I'll give you the number from a week ago. Did you see how much money he has spent? $350 million. That's a staggering sum of money. Elif, double-check that at the end of this podcast, but so help me. Elif, you're sitting there. Double-check that number for me. $350 million.
And he seems to be selling it or spending it very well. I mean, he's got some great ads going on. Very memorable ads. I can't recall any right now.
But I really know there's the one that juxtaposes
him and Obama.
Trump and other presidents.
With other presidents.
Yeah. Ask what you can do for your country.
Knock the crap out of them, would you?
Their cause must be our cause, too.
I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody, and I wouldn't lose any voters.
Mr. Gorbachev,
tear down this wall.
Build that wall.
And then the ones with him and Obama,
him
too,
and Obama really are good, strong, yeah. Because if you had, I had it on silent or mute the first time I saw it, it came into the room like, did he just get an endorsement? I was like, am I missing this? And in fact, no, it was just an ad, and it was like seven or eight different handshake. Hello, we're buddies. Hi.
I want to circle back to what Justin brought up, this tape of Bloomberg talking about young African-American men, saying like 90% of them commit the murders and 90% of them are victims of murders, neither of which are true, by the way. Those are very inflated figures. But these remarks that he really has got to walk back, and he is going to have to work very hard to get African-American congressmen, African-American spiritual leaders, and so on his side if he becomes the nominee. I think, and I've heard this said quite a bit, that African-American voters are attentive, and they really want to beat Trump. They want to beat Trump as much as anybody else does. And so they may not hold these old remarks against him when it comes down to, well, you're going to vote for Trump and all of his issues, or are you going to vote for Bloomberg, who has some things in his past that he's apologized for, which Trump would not know what it means to apologize or something. He never has apologized for anything. Well,
but they hold it against Buttigieg. At least the media acts like the African-American community holds it against Buttigieg for the race relations in South Bend. So why doesn't Mike Bloomberg get the same treatment?
I think we're talking about groups of people as if they're monoliths,
right?
And I don't know that we can say all African-American voters are going to care about this, all white voters are going to care about that.
Well, you know,
some of them will hold it against, some will hold it against Buttigieg, and a whole heck of a lot won't.
Amy Klobuchar has got some issues she's going to have to deal with as a prosecutor in Minnesota, where apparently she went after some cases that were not very good.
One of the things they said about Buttigieg and the black vote was, again, the gay issue, that African-Americans were less likely to support a gay candidate. Which is certainly convenient when you look at the numbers. But then I heard Al Sharpton say, you know, he said, look at Chicago. Chicago elected a gay married woman overwhelmingly, and it wasn't an issue here. So maybe that's overblown too.
I think some of it too is he does not have the ground game. He does not have the money in the organization. Pete Buttigieg, people don't know him in places like South Carolina, which has a huge African-American population, huge, you know, African American electorate, and so the messaging isn't there. He just doesn't have the money or the ground game.
Vote for myself, and if I stop for a minute to think who you're going to vote for, who blacks are going to vote for, who can win, just said who gives me the most confidence standing there and managing America, to me it's Amy or it's Pete. I don't know if that means they're going to win it, but whenever Pete Buttigieg talks, I feel pretty good.
Reassured, he's a thinking man.
I really
man,
do.
Yeah.
Even when you know he's up against the wall about race relations in South Bend or something like that, and then he says, "Yeah, boy, we screwed that up, and here's what we're going to do." And maybe that's chatter, but he's unflappable.
He provides the starkest contrast to what is happening in the White House.
I imagine him on a debate stage.
I was going to say that might sway independents, where they're like, I just want a different look to what's happening in politics. And Pete Buttigieg is the closest to being like,
he's not going
to
get in the mud with Donald Trump the way a Bernie would, or Elizabeth Warren would,
or Mike Bloomberg.
It is interesting, though, that his support, he has old people supporting him.
Yeah.
And Bernie Sanders has young people, which is fascinating.
Yeah,
to me,
isn't it, though? By the way, $350 was the right number, million dollars.
To go back to this point about Buttigieg not having the organization or the money, the same problem is being faced by Klobuchar. Mm-hmm. She doesn't have the she put a lot of her eggs in the Iowa and then in some New Hampshire basket. She did much better than people expected in New Hampshire. The question is she going to come out of New Hampshire the way like Paul Tsongas came out of New Hampshire?
Nah.
It's like, oh my gosh, I've won, but I don't have anything. I mean, and then right after Nevada and South Carolina, you've got Super Tuesday, right?
Yep.
Isn't that March 3rd and 4th, whatever, early March, when you're playing in all these different areas and you need hundreds of millions of dollars. Apparently she raised, what, $6 million?
On that speech.
On that debate performance.
Then you get to St. Patrick's Day and it's like, Illinois.
Illinois. Yeah. Like, oh. Here we are. Hey,
like the last ones. It's like,
But I mean, this is sort of a problem with the system, which is that you have these people who are doing, and I think that you are a fool to overlook the capacity that Bloomberg has to make people think like, well, and he does go up against Trump in a nice way. When Trump tweets at him, he tweets right back. He was tweeting this week about...
Is that how we're going to pick the next president?
Well, there? I want someone who stands up to him. Trump was making fun of his height, of Bloomberg's height.
Yeah.
And something like... And Bloomberg tweeted back, something like, where I come from, we measure height from the neck up.
So I do think Justin's right. The contrast between Pete and Donald on stage would be good. I think Amy would be very cool, calm, and collected. She didn't fall apart in those Supreme Court in the Supreme Court hearings.
Right. Does anybody around the table here sort of sad that Kamala Harris is out already?
Yes.
That because because Iowa and New Hampshire just didn't give her the traction she needed. She didn't survive until South Carolina, Nevada, where she might have had a better chance. I find her to be a very impressive person.
I don't know that she's gone. I think she resurfaces as a vice president.
Oh, yeah, you're probably right.
I think she's being courted right now.
That's why I think Pete or Amy are also going to be viable as vice presidential candidates for one of those guys.
I think if you're going to have a more moderate candidate, then you're going to have an African American, you're going to have to have somebody younger, because you know Bloomberg is 78 years old. I mean, that gives me some pause.
In the Republican primary in 2016, where it was just a fight to whoever and they all hated each other. I mean, everybody hated each other, and Trump was really at the center of that. And I wonder if you think about politics in an ensemble, where you think of this Democratic field, and this field has the Mike Bloomberg who can get nasty on Twitter. It has the Pete Buttigieg's, the contrast, who can be younger and level-headed. It has the Elizabeth Warren and the Bernie Sanders that are like free health care for all or whatever the issues are. It seems to be much more ensemble or collaborative at the end of the day. If they can figure out a way to say, we're all going to be president. Like we're not like the last one where we're just out for blood and the winner wins and the rest. We're all going to be in this cabinet.
Bernie Sanders said something kind of similar to that during his speech. His supporters are obnoxious, but Sanders himself does not project that. You know, it's either Bernie or bust, those kind of people. I think that at the end of the day, a great percentage of the Democratic electorate is going to have to swallow hard and vote for someone who they didn't initially support because that person is vastly preferable to Donald Trump. And you have to kind of grow up about that. You have to say, like, you know what? I'm not going to vote for a symbolic candidate. I'm not going to sit home. I'm going to realize the stakes of this election, which I think we are seeing in vivid terms in this past week since Trump off the chain is messing around in the Justice Department, is frog marching Vindman out of the White House and all of the appalling things that he's doing just since he was acquitted. That those are the sort of stakes. We're looking at four more years of that. Imagine what Trump will be like once he's reelected.
Did he overstep his bounds with the Roger Stone intervention?
Oh, totally. Totally. I am hoping that the judge in the Roger Stone case is an Obama appointee. Mm-hmm. And I hope that she has been following this in the news and that she does not pay any attention to this new Justice Department sentencing memo. And she realizes what happened here. And she gives the sentence to Roger Stone that he deserves and that follows the sentencing
guidelines.
Isn't
this just the long haul? Isn't this just the long game to be pardoned? So now he can say, I pardon because of all this stuff as opposed to for my own political game.
Yes, and the headline is sort of, I had to pardon him because this Obama appointee. That's my...
Sure, of course.
They've all screwed him over. Everybody here was biased. I'm the only one that survived.
But he has the Trump card, doesn't he?
So to speak, he does. Yeah.
You're right.
But she has to take a stand here because what's going on is just flagrant and disgusting, and these prosecutors, they ought to all get the Medal of Freedom for resigning this case.
One resigned the department and the other three to resign the case.
Yeah, I mean, it is unthinkable what they're doing to the Justice Department. And I understand that the people within the Justice Department, rank-and-file employees, are frustrated, scared, angry about this. But what are we going to do about it? What happens, democracies don't fall overnight with tanks in the streets. They fall when the institutions start crumbling and they don't do any good. People have pointed out that, there's a parliament in Russia. There's parliaments in China. They're just meaningless. And if you end up with a Senate that we have, a Republican Senate that basically is meaningless right now. All they do is just ratify whatever Trump wants. I mean, that's how democracy starts to die.
When you look at the big picture and you look at it, you say, okay, so in this case, first it was the prosecutors, then it was the judge, now it's the jury.
No, it's going after the jury, right.
And I don't this idea that the American people would all believe that everybody that was involved in this prosecution was corrupt or was part of a deep state, it starts to get so big that you're like, I can't believe anyone would actually buy that. Like, no one would step forward. Pat Brady has made a couple points when we were on Cochran together. He's like, you know, when you talk about collusion and things like that and the deep state, he's like, you get all these guys, I paraphrase, he's got a great story about it. He's like, you can't decide on buying paperclips. You know, like, there's no deep state conspiracy. These guys can't do it.
Pat Brady is an indoor Republican, for those who don't know.
but my former prosecutor. But the idea being, at the end of the day, this notion that everybody involved in the Roger Stone case, from the 12 in the box to the judge to the prosecutors that are Justice Department lifers, they're all in on screw over the American people. I don't know, man. It gets really hard to make that argument. And I guess it's working because you listen to some of the programs that are going to be for the president and his policies. They buy it. I don't know what to make
of it. Job approval numbers are up. I mean, they are as high now as they've been for a very long time. After he survived impeachment, he ticked up and is as high as he's been in years.
Wasn't that an outlier, that one poll? That was one Gallup poll that had him really close
to 50%. That's what I'm thinking of, the Gallup poll.
I think that was an outlier. I think he's still hovering in the low 40s.
And you know, you get revisionist history here, too. And I feel like the Mueller report, and I don't know.
He wants to investigate Mueller.
Yeah, he's next. But the Mueller report went from what I can remember, just trying to look at this objectively, that Robert Mueller said, there are a lot of things in here that were crimes, but I can't prosecute a president, right? That's the idea that came out of that. I'm not going to suggest to do that because there's still rules about presidents above the law kind of thing. Now it's gone to everything. I've been exonerated. Everything in there was a scam. Everything in is a witch hunt. Everyone's got to go down. And I don't understand
how the Mueller report exonerated him fully.
Well, I think
I don't understand what's going on here.
I think he's trying to hitch the Mueller report. That was almost immediate. He's trying to hitch the whole Mueller report to being exonerated in the impeachment. He said it almost immediately.
It's not just him. It's a lot of right wing media is doing the same thing. I don't know. Is that true? At the end of the day, is it true that all of the claims were baseless, that they couldn't figure out, the investigation found nothing, that the president was exonerated?
It's not at all.
It's just hanging in the ether. Yeah, no.
What about the impeaching Barr? What about the other way?
We don't have the institutional structure anymore to do things like that. Barr definitely deserves to be impeached for this. he definitely does, but it'd be futile. It would be like trying to impeach the president. The Republicans in the Senate do not take seriously their job to hold people to account and to perform in accordance with the Constitution.
Well, I'm just thinking about it politically too, Eric, that if you did it, boy, that would add more to the arsenal of Republicans who just say anything you don't like, you impeach now.
I get letters from them all the time. I managed to work Trump into my column this morning about how the fact that when the law gets broken, you know, the public wants the law to be followed. When the law is broken, except in the case of the president, when about half the people don't care, and I just I'm flooded with mail from people like, get over, you got Trump derangement syndrome. And it's like, if there's ever a time to be a little deranged about what's going on in this country, now is the time. So I cop to that.
NBA All-Star Weekend.
How invisible is that? I mean, I heard your promo today, and I know you're talking about it. I plan on talking about it because it's a who's who of athletes and
Obama's
comedians.
Obama's going to be here now.
The president's going to be here, and
John.
Those aren't tickets. They're public tickets. You can't go up to the United Center and get to see the NBA All-Star. It's sold out. And it was sold out for a long time.
On the secondary market,
I'm sure on the secondary market. But the point being that then you don't see as much marketing budget being thrown at billboards and other things. The All-Star Week is here. They don't need to do that because they're not selling tickets. So it really just becomes a celebrity event.
Even the Obama thing is like a very small audience.
It's like Kanye West is coming to the UIC Pavilion. You see that? He's doing the Sunday service.
Really?
Yeah, on Sunday.
Oh, he's going to do his service?
He's still doing
that whole gospel
thing. I'm like, what a crazy he's going to be at the UIC Pavilion. It's the All-Star Weekend.
I'm intrigued by the format of the game. Now they're going to play each quarter is going to be its own separate little game. And then at the end, they're going to play up to a certain number of points, 24 points, I guess.
I can't wait to see all those Chicago Bulls on the court.
Oh, that's right.
Wait a minute. No, Justin, I hate to tell you, but...
not one.
But, I mean, no one's going to play any defense. It's just fabulous.
Steve Bertrand just walked back in to say, Steve, it's a pleasure having you here today. Thanks for joining us.
He's been here the whole time. He just got quiet during the national politics.
I wrote a newscast. I gave it, and now I'm back.
I held the silent sign.
So any last things you want to say?
No, I just want to say I really appreciate doing the podcast with you, and I think the way you lead it and the order in which we talk about topics is fantastic.
I'm sure we'll go local first. I know that screws you. That's Steve Bertrand, who's just returned for me to say, that's Steve Bertrand. Eric Zorn, your name.
Lisa Donovan with the foil hat.
Lisa Donovan. The foil hat. I thought we were all going to be wearing the face mask, yeah, right. Coronavirus face mask. Justin Kaufman, thanks for coming in.
I've got a ton if you want them. I ordered them.
Don't forget the dog face pony columnist.
We're produced by Elif Garris. I'm John Williams. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNradio.com. Plus, catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.